This is the World Soccer Talk Pod. My name is not Nick Webster. No, that's right. The Uncle Fester slash Paul Konchesky lookalike that is. He's off doing wonderful things for the Institution of American Soccer, coaching ODP down in Arizona this weekend. My name is Nate Abarea, filling in the hosting seat. And alongside yours truly from all around this great country, we have Robin Burt, Grant Kerr, and Kardik Krish Nair. We start off down in Los Angeles, where Tubby is putting down the Chardonnay for the next hour or so to get this podcast going. Robin Burt, why don't you let the loyal listeners of the World Soccer Talk Pod know how they can get a hold of you and tell you that West Ham are falling down fast.
Maybe so. Yeah, they can get hold of me at BertieBoy11. And I want to congratulate you, Nate, on, taking over the reins from Nick. You probably can't do any worse than he can do. And I just want to just add one little bit here is that, you know, you guys follow me on Twitter, but I got my first real celebrity today. It was Brad Jones, the Houston Dynamo midfielder. He probably followed me by mistake, but nonetheless, he's following me.
Fantastic. We head from Los Angeles, California, over to NYC, the Big Apple, Grant Kerr, who has a busy week of travel ahead of him up and down the Eastern Seaboard, down to Fort Lauderdale, then back to Philadelphia. Grant Kerr, how are you, sir? I want you to let the listeners know how they can get a hold of you.
Good, thanks. My Twitter is at Grant Kerr Media. Yeah, I'm going down to the. I'll be in Philadelphia for the convention for the at the end of the week for a few days. So if anyone's there and wants to connect, then of course I'd like to do that.
Well, and again, Grant Kerr, you may know this if you're a listener of this show, comes in third place in my rank of favorite Scotsman on planet Earth, just behind Craig Ferguson and Derek Ray, and ahead of Sean Connery, because I have a personal relationship with Grant Kerr. Don't exactly know Mr. Connery all too well. Okay, we talk about Fort Lauderdale, where Grant is going to be paying a visit. That is, of course, the locale of one Kardik Krish Nair, the loyal Manchester City supporter that is. And Kardik has had some very, very interesting things to say on worldsoccertalk.com over the last week with various articles relating to that fiasco that is Frank Lampard, Manchester City, and NYCFC. We'll get into that a little bit later in the program. In the meantime, Kardik, why don't you let the listeners know how they can get a hold of you?
Well, if you're at the NSCAA convention in Philadelphia, you can come see me. Or if you're at the MLS Combine in Fort Lauderdale later this week, or at the Ronaldo press conference. He's not Ronaldo. He's Ronaldo. He's Brazilian. That is Wednesday, being announced as the team owner of our Fort Lauderdale Strikers. Grant Kerr, former Fort Lauderdale Striker player. When I was the press officer, we used to work out of the same office way back when, 2011. You can find me on Twitter at KK. FLA 737, like the airplane, 737.
And you can find me on Twitter at DarthNader99. You can listen to this show on TuneIn, Stitcher, and iTunes. And on that Twitter sphere, that wild thing known as Twitter, be sure to always include the hashtag WSTPod. This is the Prem Review Show, and let's get right into it with the last match of a Premier League weekend. Oh, when the Saints go marching in into Old Trafford, goes Southampton. They win 1-0. Man United's unbeaten streak is over. And this was a Dutch chess match at its finest. Ronald Koeman absolutely destroying tactically Louis van Gaal. 69th minute goal from Dusan Tadic off the bench for the Saints on a fantastic finish, quite frankly, after Pelle had hit the post, and really great form to keep that thing down and placed in for the winner in the 69th minute. But I want to go straight to you, Bertie. This was Dutch masterclass from Mr. Koeman. Southampton, with 21 matches played, are in third place. They leapfrogged Man United as a result of these 3 points. Can this team finish in the top four?
They really can, you know, especially after today's game. I really think now that they have defined their season. Beating Manchester United at Old Trafford puts down a really big marker for them. They were struggling, as you know, for about, I don't know, 5 or 6 games before these recent games. And everybody thought, okay, the wheels are falling off, there's injuries, there's suspensions and stuff like that. But they've really said something today, and I really enjoyed the way they played. I was really quite surprised how they came at United. I mean, United dominated, I thought, that first period of the play. But when Tadic came on, it just seemed to change everything, the mood. I just loved the way that Southampton went forward, and they did it in a very calm and in a very calculated way, which is exactly what Koeman, you know, would want from his team. But kudos to them. I think they are going to be around for the next couple of months. And, you know, if you had to say, are they going to finish in the top four today? Yeah, I think they probably could.
Well, quite frankly, United in the second half of this match were piss poor, in my humble opinion. We'll get to that here in a second. I want to stay on the positive train here with Southampton, and I want to go to Grant Kerr, who you're a current player yourself, and you've played for a variety of clubs in a variety of countries, and we've talked about this before, you've been on teams that are quote-unquote deep. You've been on teams that are maybe only 11 or 12 deep. The knock on this Southampton team right now is that at best, they are 14, maybe 15 players deep. If a couple key injuries hit them in the next month, there is absolutely no way that they stay in the top four. With that being said, if all 14 or 15 of those players stay healthy and the footballing gods are kind to them for the next 4 months, I absolutely could see them finishing in the top four. And I'm going to ask you, as a current player and someone who's dealt with injuries and been around the game of football on such an up-close level for such a long time, can the footballing gods be that kind to a team that lacks the depth the way Southampton does?
It's tough to say. Also, it'll be difficult for them to see out if they keep playing so well, like in this month with the transfer window as well. I mean, obviously Schneiderlin, especially after today's performance. I saw Gary Neville on Sky after, he was talking about him and saying, you know, he's proven himself the last couple of years and he's the real deal. And I saw Wenger saying, you know, pretty much they're going to try and sign Schneiderlin for Arsenal. But like you say, the drop off is pretty high from, they don't have the squad that the Man City's have and, you know, Chelsea, but their starting 11 is as good as anyone. They were comparing the midfield of Wanyama and Schneiderlin against, you know, Arsenal's today. They had Coquelin and Rosicky as the, you know, and like if you would take those two, I mean, personally, I would every day of the week over those two. They have such a strong side. And like was earlier said, when they said they had their little blip where they looked like it would have been easier for them just to kind of tail off and still have a great season, finish 9th or 10th. But they've come back and they've actually recovered so well. And they're such an organized, balanced team. And they've taken 7 points from the last three, the United game, the Arsenal game, and the Chelsea game. I mean, so it'll be interesting to see, though, if they can hold on to, I mean, they've already been raided enough last summer, but it worked out pretty well for them. But, you know, if they can hold on to Schneiderlin and, like, if the football gods are kind to them, then, yeah, I mean, they could be in the top four. Man United are fourth and Arsenal are fifth, and they've been, I know United had a 10-game run there, but these teams haven't been that strong this year. They're definitely, this is such a big chance for Southampton to, you know, finish fourth, and then they'll be able to attract a bigger, better players, and, you know, the squad will build and the people will want to go there. So it's exciting times for the club.
Well, it all comes down to health for the Saints, obviously. And again, Southampton and Ronald Koeman, they've taken advantage of parity that I don't think this league has seen in the past decade, and really just, quite frankly, a down year in the Premier League. And yours truly in Cardiff, we talked about this back a couple weeks ago. Have we ever seen a team lose 4, even 5 on the trot and then still be in the top four? I don't think that's ever happened in the modern Premier League era. We'll have to get in touch with the MIA stat man, David Mossy, to check in if that is indeed true. Okay, let's switch over to Manchester United. Cardick, the Twitter sphere was so much fun to check in with at about 10 a.m. California time this morning at the end of this match. And the way people were saying that a Sir Alex Ferguson-led Man United team would have either come back to level or even win this match, or they would have lost 2-0. And even former Man United players were tweeting things out saying that, no, the spine, the attitude, saying that we are going to go down throwing punches. We are not going to resort to playing very simple Route 1 football long balls up to Fellaini, and that being our only option to get back into this game. A lot of people questioning the desire from the manager, from Van Gaal, and I think he was tactically destroyed today. Talk about that kind of viewpoint from Man United supporters who saw a lacking of a fight from this team once they went down 1-0.
Yeah, that's certainly true under Sir Alex. I've seen matches where they lost at Old Trafford, where they lost because they gave up a late counterattacking goal because they were throwing everything forward to try and get that equalizer or that winner. I remember a game against Aston Villa. I think it's the only time Aston Villa has beaten them in the last 40 Premier League matches or something. Martin O'Neill's final season or next to final season at Villa, he beat them 3-1 because they were down 2-1. They threw everything forward. Friedel had to make a bunch of saves, and then I think Ashley Young or Van Gaal scored on the counter. But that was Manchester United. Okay, they would throw their best punch at you. You weren't going to get out of Old Trafford without them taking a shot on target. I mean, think about that. Think about when was the last time you saw a Manchester United side? I know they had some poor performances last year under David Moyes, but when did they not even put a shot on target in a match that was this critical, a match against another side that's near them in the table? It's just shocking. And quite frankly, the thing I don't like about this back three that Van Gaal is playing, and I like the back three with some other sides, depending on their personnel. We saw Hull use it very effectively a few seasons ago in the championship. Steve Bruce got them promoted using that system. We've seen Brendan Rodgers use it at times. Martinez use it at times. Roberto Mancini used it for many games for Manchester City a few seasons ago. But they do not have the distribution from that back three, those center backs, to play this system. And then the shield in front of those back three can get opened up very easily. Michael Carrick is not as mobile a holding midfielder as he used to be. I thought Blind was pretty good today, but you saw just a lack of ability to even link up. So Wayne Rooney is starting in the midfield. Some controversy about where he's starting, playing in the midfield, and Di Maria up top instead. And then he's drifting deeper and deeper as the match goes on. He's drifting deeper and deeper to get service and to link up. Then flinging long balls forward for Fellaini. It just seemed to be route one, no real plan B, and really kind of a shocking tactical display from United.
I think the words to describe that second half performance from Man United would be clueless and desperate, and that has got to come back down to the manager and to put a bow on this fantastic finish to the Premier League weekend, being the Sunday nighter over there at Old Trafford. We'd need a whole nother show entirely to break down the relationship between Ronald Koeman and Louis van Gaal, and the smile that has got to be on Koeman's face this evening is from ear to ear. That has got to be so satisfying. And you talk about near each other in the table, Southampton, again, leapfrogging Manchester United into third place. It is oh so nice. Let's shift over to another 1-0 match. We went from the last game of the Premier League weekend. We'll go to the first match of the Premier League weekend that was my beloved Liverpool staying on this unbeaten run. 6 unbeaten now for Liverpool. 1-0 on the road against Sunderland at the Stadium of Light. An 8th-minute goal from the Czar, Lazar Markovic. And the first time I saw the Serbian play, I said something to a friend. I said, you know who he reminds me of? He reminds me of Steve McManaman. And that was before Liverpool had signed him. Then they pick him up. The long hair, the lumbering runs down the wing. There was a goal that Steve McManaman scored at Celtic Park back in the late 90s. I think it was about 1997. For any of you that want to look that goal up, you remember that goal, Grant, and that's a goal very similar. I know Barini was involved with a pass in the goal that Markovic scored today, but I watched the goal that the Czar scores today, and I go, okay, now I'm really starting to see why I was reminded of Steve McManaman. And you're going, God, he's not even moving that fast. It's almost like it's moving in slow motion, yet it's getting by people. It has control on the ball. The hair's flapping. There's something there. He was unlucky to not get a second goal in the 29th minute, a great volley that hit the crossbar after beating the keeper. Now, Markovic has been a topic of so much criticism, that comical sending off against Basel in the Champions League, really starting to get put in that list of Brendan Rodgers failures that were brought in. Grant, I want to go to you. Where do you rate Markovich after today's performance and overall from what you've seen in his first few months as a Liverpool player?
Well, I'm sure he wishes he came into the team last year when Suarez and everyone was there, and it was everything was going so well for Liverpool. It's been a tough time for all the new signings. They've obviously contributed to the not so good season so far, but it's obviously tough. I mean, he's only 20 years old, the guy, and comes into the English Premier League. You never know how long it's going to take people to adapt and stuff. The guy has a lot of talent, like you say. He runs like McManaman, I think, because he has his head up the whole time when he has the ball. You know, like he dribbles forward and he's always got his head lifted. He looks a really exciting player. I mean, yesterday he had a great game. The volley off the bar was really good. I think Liverpool's starting to pick up a bit. You know, I think they probably would have lost that game before Christmas. I think they may be getting Higuain. They were talking. I was reading about if they can get rid of Balotelli. That is probably, but that's another issue. But it's been a tough one for Liverpool, and it's tough for the signings, you know, to come into a team and everything at Liverpool. It's like playing for one of the biggest teams in the world. You're going to be over, everything's hyped up and over. It's over, you know, if you play great, you're the best player in the world. If you play bad, you're the worst. You week to week, it changes. So for a 20-year-old to come in, he's done pretty well. I saw Brendan Rodgers said he brought him in his office and told him to be more aggressive, and then the next game he did that against Basel and he got sent off. So, but I think he's adapting now, and of course once you get more comfortable in your surroundings, and you know, he'll start to blossom. But he looks like he definitely got a lot of potential. Well, he's a good footballer.
Well, Grant, you talk about inconsistency, and I want to go to you, Cardick, because Liverpool, with all that you could say about this debacle of a season, they're unbeaten in their last six games, and dare I say it, they are 5 points off a Champions League spot, climbing back to respectability. But now comes this time of, okay, where from here? So I'm going to quote perhaps the four most famous scousers of all time. Tell me why, Cardick, or why not, Liverpool are going to finish in the top four. Tell me why not.
I'll tell you why, because their top players have not hit their stride yet. Jordan Henderson hasn't had the kind of season he had last season. Stevie G's going to want to go out with a bang. Danny Sturridge has been injured for this entire season. Sterling hit a wall because he was having to carry too much of a load, but I think his games are being managed better now. His minutes are being managed better now, and he'll excel in the second half of the season. Why not? Manchester United and Arsenal have not been fully fit to this point. I think Arsenal, you saw Ozil come on today. You saw Theo Walcott come on today. You're seeing Alexis Sanchez take the Premier League by storm. So you have to assume Arsenal finishes in the top four. Then Manchester United, we know, are stacked player for player, and they spent £200 million in the last two windows. The question is, do they have the wherewithal to finish in the top four? So that's why, and that's why. And then, of course, Southampton, great story, and if they can keep everybody fit, keep Schneiderlin and Wanyama in the team, resist the temptation to sell him. Jay Rodriguez, also a guy we haven't talked about this season, is close to coming back from injury for Southampton. That's a pretty big deal if he gets back and is able to contribute. So that's why and why not for Liverpool.
Okay, Robin Burt, I want to go down to Los Angeles and that little fallacy down the street from you known as the Los Angeles Galaxy, where it has just become official this past week that Steven Gerrard, my favorite footballer of all time, the beloved homegrown scouse, captain, cop hero, it's his official 18-month contract with the Los Angeles Galaxy starting up in July. The coddled league pet, titty-sucking baby of Don Garber and Major League Soccer, that club known as the Los Angeles Galaxy. Okay, since this went official, Steven Gerrard followed through. As soon as the deal with MLS became publicized, he scored 4 goals in his next 2 matches. He seems to have a rejuvenated sense about him. And we've talked so much about the David Beckham fiasco that was. We're going to get into the Frank Lampard fiasco that is. I was talking with Grant before we started the show this evening. Steven Gerrard, I'm telling you, has got a new fire in his eyes, and it's as if he's going to go through the same thing that those other players we mentioned have gone through, where I have a feeling that come May, if he ends strong the way he might be able to, if he keeps playing the way he's playing the last week or so, and he might look himself in the mirror and go, my God, I've got more left in the tank than I realized.
Yeah, he's got a whole lot more in the tank left. And it's interesting, you know, since they actually signed him, I think he's playing better than he was, you know, let's say a month ago. And sometimes, you know, when you know something finished and, you know, and you're moving on to something new, you don't care about, and you can play with a much more relaxed sort of way. And I think that's exactly what's happening with Steven Gerrard. I think it is too early. It is too early for him to just sort of do what Frank Lampard is doing and what David Beckham did. I mean, David Beckham had more left in the tank. And look what he did after MLS. He went and played for PSG and he played for Milan, and Gerrard is one of those, you know, he's one of those unique gems. He's one of those very unique players that he will unlock a defense with one long pass. He will score a free kick at that most unique time that he needs to do that. Look, he will do very well at the Galaxy. He will probably be celebrated. They'll probably win, you know, the championship next year. But I think he'll have regrets, and you know. He's only 34 years old. He's got at least another 3 years in him, possibly two, where his engine can go so far. I mean, he's one of those mature players that doesn't have to rely on, you know, on that youthful sort of athletic type of ability that some of these other players have. He has so much experience that he brings to the table that he's going to be playing with an abundance all the way through the end of the season. And I still think this whole Frank Lampard thing, I mean, it's all farcical, the fact, you know, the whole deal there. Supposedly, he had signed with
Birdie, we're going to get to that in a second. We're going to get to that debacle that is the Frank Lampard situation here momentarily. But you brought up Steven Gerrard hitting free kicks, those iconic set piece, just mastermind beauties that Steven Gerrard has. And one game that we didn't get a chance to talk about last week on our mini FA Cup review with Liverpool taking on Wimbledon on a Monday night over there. Steven Gerrard scores two goals in that game, one on a beautiful header, and the winner to break a 1-1 deadlock on one of the finest free kicks that I've ever seen him take, and he's taken hundreds of fantastic free kicks. And a quick shout out to hashtag beast mode Akinfenwa from AFC Wimbledon. All this talk about Higuain to Liverpool and Berahino. I want Akinfenwa at Liverpool. No, maybe not, but if you enjoy a ginormous human being making his presence known on the soccer pitch, be sure to check out what Akinfenwa did against Liverpool back last Monday. Okay, let's end up this Liverpool-Sunderland talk. I'm going to go to all three of you right now, starting with Grant. Sunderland, 1 point off the drop. Do Gus Poyet's gang stay in the Premier League, yes or no?
It depends if Stephen Fletcher comes back. I'm biased because I'm Scottish, but I don't think they have many goals in the team. They didn't even test the defence, you know, and Liverpool's defence is really shaky and Mignolet is struggling, and they didn't even test them at all yesterday. So unless they can get Stephen Fletcher fit and, you know, create more chances, then there might be enough teams below, though, so it's going to be a close one.
Why don't you ride the fence even more, Grant Kerr? Cardick, you have said in the past that Sunderland are quote-unquote too big to go down. I confuse that for a Malky Mackay text message. Do you still stand by the fact that Sunderland are quote-unquote too big of a club to go down?
Oh, no, I don't think they're too big to go down. I think it's bad for the Premier League if a club that big goes down. But they will go down. Last season, they stayed in the league because of Borini and because of Key, two players who were on loan who were back at their parent clubs at Liverpool and Swansea, respectively. And Key's having a very good season with the Swans. That's why they stayed in the league. And then Fletcher's goals when he was fit. I think they go down. Unless they buy someone. There's talk now, Neil Ashton reported earlier today about a swap potentially to get Jermaine Defoe over from MLS, sending Altidore the other way. A guy like Defoe would really help them. He's the kind of assassin, goal poacher, guy who can give you goals off the bench that they would need if they're going to stay in this league. Short of making a deal like that, I think they probably go down.
I'll tell you what, if you're reaching for Jermaine Defoe from Toronto FC as your lifeline, you are going down. I'm saying it, Sunderland. Leave the Premier League as of May 2015. They'll probably be back in a year. It's what they do. They're a yo-yo, and they've always been one. We move on to another Merseyside club, another club that I have quite a soft spot for. Their lovely supporters have always treated my little Yankee butt with quite a lot of kindness and respect. And I speak, of course, of Roberto Martinez's gang over there at Everton, who end a four-match losing streak, not a winless streak, four straight losses for Everton. And even with this draw against the reigning champions, Manchester City at Goodison Park this weekend, still just 3 points technically off the drop zone. It was a wild 5 minutes in the second half that saw Fernandinho head home, 74th minute, looking like he was going to give Man City a sure win. But Naismith equalizes in the 78th for Everton. And I've got to say, Joe Hart came out flapping, looking like David James in the 1996 FA Cup final for Liverpool against Manchester United. It came out flapping with absolutely no confidence, but it wasn't just Joe Hart on that set piece. Man City has had a way about them on set pieces that look so unconfident. Call it what you will, they look frazzled on set pieces. And now, Cardick, you are unlike 99.9% of Manchester City supporters in the United States and around the world. You are not a glory-hunting bandwagoner. You've got a quite a nice published book, actually, to prove that you are not a bandwagoner, Sky Blue. But you know English football as well as anyone. You've been around it for decades, and you know how important defending set pieces is to winning a Premier League title. If Man City defends set pieces like they did today, and it cost them 2 points, how on earth are they going to win the Premier League title this year?
They won't, and that's it's as simple as that. The defending on set pieces has gotten sloppier and sloppier as the season's gone on. Runners coming free, bad marking. But I have to say, Everton continues to shock me. This is a match, and maybe this is just from a Man City perspective. This is a match, if David Moyes were managing Everton, they would have won. Everton would have taken the full 3 points. And quite frankly, Moyes never lost more than one game in a row to Manchester City in his career. They were the bogey team for City. Now City seems to be able to collect points from Roberto Martinez. That, to me, is a clear indication of kind of where things have gone. Not very pragmatic, not very practical, very open, which is why City was able to batter Everton in the first half. City's never been able to batter Everton sides at Goodison, except for these last 2 years at Goodison, since Martinez has been the manager. But I guess the Scottish Messi came up with the goal, and Everton gets a point, but they I'm real concerned about Everton from what I see, quite frankly. I don't know, with the European campaign kicking back off again, they might get sucked into this relegation fight, as crazy as that sounds.
Well, from the Scottish Messi we go to, I guess we'll call him the Scottish Ronaldo, over here with Grant Kerr over there at NYC. You have had some, to put it lightly, mixed words regarding Roberto Martinez as a manager this season, especially in comparison to the overachieving that Everton had last year under his wise tutelage over there at Goodison Park. Now, Cardick hinted at the Europa League situation. Yours truly, Nick Webster, David Mossy, we have all pretty much said that it seems like Roberto Martinez is putting all of his competitive eggs in the Europa League basket and almost treating the marquee competition that is the English Premier League as a second priority, as a secondary concern. Now, that's all fine and dandy if Everton finish mid-table and go and win the Europa League or make it deep in the rounds of the Europa League. No one expected them to quite frankly, build off of last year. Last year, I thought, was such an overachievement for that club. But I see what he was doing. Okay, they're 3 points off the drop right now. I mean, can Everton use this result today as a springboard in the Premier League itself? Or is it going to go back to Roberto Martinez caring only about the Europa League and Everton, as Cardick said, sniffing around 15th, 16th, 17th, dare I say 18th place?
Yeah, it's a dangerous plan. You know, it's a dangerous game to play. Just thinking like that, it's so close at the bottom just now, and it's only, like you say, they're one result out of the drop zone, and all these teams are capable of beating each other and picking up, you know, 3 points. You know, Burnley are starting to play. So I thought yesterday, though, they did look better than they have done. They looked a bit more like the old Everton. They still, like Kartik said, they're still trying to play the expansive football, so there's a lot of gaps, and they haven't kept a clean sheet for 11 games. You know, with Moyes, they used to be much more organized and especially at home, like Kartik said, you never have them in their own half for the whole time. Or if you did, they would be really like two banks of four, and you know, we wouldn't be getting through there so easily. But I thought yesterday they actually did look quite, you know, they looked a bit better. Man City were there. They'll be disappointed that they go up 1-0 in the 75th minute and they don't win the game. Lukaku looked more interested. I thought he you know, when he's on, he's a handful of the size of the guy, you know, his pace and power. But it is a dangerous one to play. I mean, Europa League, if it doesn't work out, I know he really wants to get in the Champions League. And obviously this time, if you win it, you get in the Champions League. But you don't want to be doing that and then playing in the Championship as well, you know.
Would be quite the combination. And many people on Merseyside have been throwing around the possibility, and oh, is it a mouthwatering possibility, of Liverpool and Everton perhaps meeting in the semifinals or even the final of the Europa League come May of this year. Okay, Cardick, we hinted at Frank Lampard moments ago. It came out this week that MLS never owned the contract of Manchester City's Frank Lampard. NYCFC never owned anything. He was not on loan from MLS. After recent events, Don Garber and MLS come out looking so bad in the past few days. And Kartik, you were on the pulse of the American soccer scene with everything going on in MLS over the busy December and January periods. I mean, this has got to be a black eye for the league and for those, the American soccer fans and even folks abroad who have the idea that it seems like MLS is willing to put up facades. They're willing to create illusions as long as those illusions are believed by millions as opposed to caring what is actual reality.
Right, and then they also have a very complicit press in the United States. In
spineless,
the
I'd say.
Yeah, spineless, absolutely. And I wrote about this earlier this week at World Soccer Talk, a controversial article. I got more support for it than I thought I would. I thought I was going to offend everybody to the point where I'm going to see Grant later in the week in Philly that I would be booed out of the room at the NSCAA. But a lot of people agreed with me, albeit quietly, that the press once again showed in the Lampard matter how complicit they are, how willing they are to just accept anything Don Garber says, how willing they are to cheerlead for Major League Soccer and to then say, well, Lampard's a bad guy, Manchester City's bad news, but MLS did nothing wrong here. They were taken advantage of. They were used. How dare a player see us as a second-rate league and want to stay in the Premier League for a title race and potential European run? How dare Lampard want to do this? Yet the facade, as you put it, and you're absolutely right, Nate, the facade that MLS has put up, and this isn't the first time they've done this. They have been for years putting up facades and smokescreens when it comes to being transparent about player contracts and player deals and things they do. They're protected by this cadre of media that are tied to Major League Soccer. They have been humiliated by this situation, and the reality is they never owned Lampard's rights. And I mean, perhaps there's a justification for this, which is Manchester City is under scrutiny from UEFA. They're sniffing around for FFP violations, so they realize, you know what, we better sign Lampard straight away. He's down a free anyway, because if he signs there and then he's loaned back, it appears to be some funny business, so let's be transparent for UEFA. But in that process, Major League Soccer could have come out and said, hey, you know what? The circumstances changed. He's gone to Manchester. He's now signed a contract with them, but it's still his intention to join New York City FC in 2015. Obviously, Manchester City's owners own NYCFC. They're a partner of Major League Soccer. So this is all good and well. Instead, they continue to put out this facade that he has signed a two-year deal with Major League Soccer and that he is on loan to Manchester City, which is why everybody started saying, oh, well, Manchester City is violating UEFA financial fair play. Turns out the contracts that were submitted to UEFA and the Premier League clearly showed that he was signed directly to Manchester City. But again, no American press, because they took Major League Soccer's word for it, was sniffing around this, figuring this out. It was, of course, the British press who said, oh, well, now we see from the Premier League, Lampard signed a deal directly with Manchester City. Had it been left to the American press, the people who cover MLS defined it. This facade may have continued.
Who knows how long? Who knows how long it would have taken to actually unearth the truth? It was an absolute lie. It was a smokescreen. It was a facade. And this whole NYCFC situation with fans being angry, and do fans even exist for a club that hasn't even played a single match yet? And people acting as if they're outraged and they were screwed over as season ticket holders. I said it weeks ago. Nick seconded it last week on the podcast. NYCFC has the makings of Chivas USA Part 2, and I see this thing being an epic disaster. And to put a ribbon on all this MLS talk, I've been getting so much flack and even lighthearted stick from people saying, oh man, as a Liverpool supporter, you must be devastated with the Steven Gerrard situation. And I say, no, I'm not devastated as a Liverpool supporter. Steven Gerrard was going to eventually leave Liverpool Football Club. I'm pissed off as a San Jose Earthquake supporter who has watched for years and years these league pets and the way MLS coddles and just absolutely just spoils certain markets and certain teams. And this situation with the Galaxy, what's going on with NYCFC, it all just comes back to the same point that MLS is a fraud in so many ways. I love it, and I'll still probably go to games, so I sound like a complete hypocrite. Moving on back to the Premier League. I want to bring Bertie back into the fold here because you are such a, I don't want to say fan of Agud Ery, of that man named Harry Redknapp, but we have had some in-depth conversations about the chubby red sheet head of Queen's Park Rangers, QPR, who lose 2-1 in a, it's getting to that point of the season where this you can call a crucial relegation fight match, just 17,532. That kind of sounds like a good MLS crowd at Turf Moor to watch Burnley defeat QPR 2-1. Charlie Austin did score again for QPR. But again, I want to go to you, Bertie. We have reached the point here in the Premier League season where managers are beginning to get decapitated. The guillotine is being broken out by owners all across the country. And with the Twitter sphere and the back pages of the English papers blowing up this weekend with, I don't want to say a lot of angry statements, more rational, what are becoming more and more rational questions. And that question is, Robin Burt, how much longer does Harry Redknapp last at QPR?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one because, you know, financial fair play states basically that they probably won't have very much money to buy in the January window because of all of the, you know, all of the expenses that they've incurred over the last year when they were in the championship. They're now paying for that right now, even though they get this bumper crop of the money from the TV money, you know, for the current season, they are in trouble. So the fact that they have someone like Charlie Austin is good. But the fact that they have Charlie Austin is probably not necessarily good for them because they could lose him. He's like the one player on that team that's actually really doing anything constructive. And you've got to look at Queen's Park Rangers and their away form. At home, they're not bad. They're pretty good at home. You know, it's a fairly intimidating atmosphere. It's a small ground. But when they go away from home, they have not picked up a single point this season. And Burnley, as Grant was talking about, are finding some type of momentum. And it's those teams around Queen's Park Rangers, they're going to have to pick up those points with all of the teams around them, because the teams in the top 5-10, they are going to struggle to try and win points. So Harry Redknapp, his time is coming very close. I don't know whether Fernandez will go, okay, done, I've got to find somebody else, like they've done with you know, with Crystal Palace, with Pardew, and Pulis with, you know, with West Brom. Because when you do change that manager, you do get that moment for about 4 or 5 games where there is this uptick in performance. And yeah, Harry Redknapp, he could be in trouble. But the good thing about them is they have good home form, and that's the only thing that they can really hold their hats on right now. But
well, that's an important point. And I was going to get to that. That the way the parity, we talk so much about the parity in the top half, the bottom half has got such a clump element to it, and people have said in the English press, and even former players and former managers looking at this very unorthodox table that is 2014, 2015 in the Premier League, and they've basically said that if QPR can hold out that home form, they might not have to win or even get a single point on the road. If they can play that type of football that they do at Loftus Road, that it may be enough for them to stay up. That is a big, big maybe. And this had the makings of a what they call a six-pointer, a huge relegation affair. And you look at where Burnley just went to, Burnley climbing out of the drop zone the way nobody in the world gave them any chance of doing. I mean, we were, I remember on this show, all of us were joking about Derby County and historically low goal outputs. We're talking even, you know, a couple months ago, we were laughing at what Burnley was and what Turf Moor represented as the land where, as the stadium where goals go to die. And suddenly, Burnley is out of the drop zone, QPR in there. Cardick, one of these teams, if you were to, if you had to fully back one of these teams to stay in the Premier League, which one would it be and why?
Oh, I said Burnley last week. Vokes is just getting back from injury. He's an important piece to this team. They just got Keane permanently from Manchester United. I like that signing. He's a defender. He actually, I believe, was at – no, his brother was at QPR last year on loan, but he was at Leicester a few seasons ago, did quite well. I like Burnley. I think Turf Moor is a fortress. It's good to have another team from Lancashire, from the northwest up, and I think they're going to win – I think they're going to get a lot of points at Turf Moor, and they showed they could go to St. James Park. They could go to the Etihad and get points, and not get points by parking the bus and playing for nil-nils, getting points by getting two goals at the Etihad and three goals at St. James Park. I like Burnley right now. And one last point, Sean Dyche was a really good manager at Watford, got wronged by the new Italian ownership that came in, the Udinese owners. He's now proving that he's a Premier League manager at Burnley, so they have the right guy, too, managing them.
And Cardick, I always love the English geography lessons. Be sure to look at your maps, folks. Get to know where these clubs are truly located and what they mean to various regions of Great Britain. Grant, put you on the spot. One of these teams to stay up. Which one are you back and why, QPR or Burnley?
I agree with Cardick. I think Burnley as well. I just think they're working so well together. You know, Dyche has them so organized, and it's just they're a proper team. It's all teamwork. They have the lowest budget in the league. They're all in it together. I mean, like QPR, you know, their wage bill is over five times the size and stuff. As Alan Shearer was saying, that Dyche should be manager of the year, actually, if he keeps them in the league. He thinks that he should win the manager of the year, which, you know, if he can keep them up, then I don't see why not.
Well, the only chance that anybody, and the tiniest little chance that anybody gave them to stay up a couple months ago was, as Cardick said, if they parked 10 buses and said, we're going to get lucky and win 1-0 every now and again and try to scrape points everywhere we can. That's not how they're playing. They're actually playing football. And you talk about a complete 180 at a club. I'm genuinely happy for what's going on at Burnley, the way people were just completely dumping on them a couple months ago and treating them like the laughing stock of not just this season, but comparing them to Derby County from 2007, 2008, or whatever year it was, that historical, just awful performance from Derby. I mean, Burnley has a chance to stay up, and I've got to agree with the panel here. Burnley stay up and QPR go down. We could call this another relegation battle as we take a trip to Leicester. And God, what a low scoring weekend in the Premier League. There wasn't a single game. In fact, there were only two games with three goals scored. One of those games was Arsenal winning 3-0. We'll get to that in a moment. And another was a 2-1 game, which we will be ending on, in my opinion, the most entertaining match of what was otherwise a pretty dry Premier League weekend. But in the midst of it, Leicester City at home, defeat Aston Villa 1-0. Paul Konchesky, everyone's favorite Nick Webster lookalike, with his first top flight goal in what must be, Statman, help me out wherever you are, 10 years. Gorgeous half volley on the stroke of halftime. Robin Burt, Leicester City, it's never a good sign when you win a match, you get 3 points, and you're still in 20th place. Do you give them even a glimmer of hope of staying up? We're talking about all these other teams in this relegation battle. Do you even give Leicester City a slight, slight chance?
Yeah, that's a really hard one. So if you look at today's game, I thought they probably could have scored 4 or 5 goals today. Now, Villa are on a sort of a downslide right now. But, yeah, I thought Villa – I'm sorry, Leicester were value for money today. They picked up – you know, they picked up Schwarzer, which is a good buy as far as, a reserve goalkeeper. And Kramaric is another good buy. He's not available right now, but – If they can buy a few more players, if they can buy, let's say, a holding midfielder, if they can pick up perhaps another striker as well, I think there is the possibility that they can do that. But it's all going to depend on all of those teams around them. It's the Burnleys, it's the Sunderlands, it's the Queen's Park Rangers, all of those teams. It all depends what happens with those teams over the next, let's say, 5 or 6 weeks. But yeah, Leicester have a chance. I was looking at West Brom's last 5 games. They've got a terrifying last 5 games. So talk about a team that has a new manager and they got a win this weekend, which was important. But they need to start scoring and winning games because their last 5, you know, 5 games are terrible. So for Leicester, I don't know who they're playing in their last few games, but they stand a chance. But they've got to start scoring goals. They've got to start drawing games as well. And it's okay to draw games because those are all very, very important points to pick up. So, you know, who knows?
Well,
are they going to stay up? I hope so because I like their manager. I like the club. I like it that it's a family-run club. It's, you know... Yeah.
Look, I love the club too. It's where I met Casey Keller. It's where Emil Heskey signed an autograph for me when I was 8 years old. Great rugby history in the city of Leicester. Fantastic club. Love them. Love the people. Spent time at Filbert Street at the old ground that is no more. Okay, all that sentimental crap aside, they're finishing in 20th place. They are going down. Absolutely no hope for the Foxes. As much as that pains me to say, Sunderland, QPR, and Leicester are going down this year. That's 18, 19, and 20 right there. Villa will pick it up. I'm calling it right now. Bertie, seamless transition. You brought up West Bromwich Albion. Saido Berahino with the winner in the 78th minute at the Hawthorns against Hull City. Another very dry 1-0 match in this Premier League weekend that was, but West Brom get all 3 points. We'll get back to the positivity of West Brom in a moment. I gotta start with Hull and go to you, Grant. How bad are Hull City right now? Because you notice the 3 teams I just named right there. I still have faith in Hull City coming back around and getting out of the drop zone. They have been such an interesting tale this year, where the first month or two of the season had people such as our own Nick Webster on this show so impressed with the football that Steve Bruce had Hull City playing, and now they might be one of the worst teams in all of England. How bad are they? Can they rebound and get anything going this season and stay out of the drop?
It's a tough one to say. The teams down at the bottom are also close together. January is going to be big for a lot of them, the ins and outs, like even, you know, one signing or one team losing someone, that could be the difference between safety and relegation. You know, Leicester City just went 3 months without a win, and then the last 3 games they've got 7 points. So, you know, if you can get like a small run together, like you say, Hull at the beginning, they had a good spell, and then they've just gone to, like, you know, really bad recently. If they can get a couple of wins in a row, or, you know, if anyone can put some type of run together, it'll be interesting if they can do anything in the window. But like you say, I just think this season they're just it's, you know, they don't really have, they're not like really good defensively, they're not really good attacking. Usually one a team is, you know, excellent at, well, good at one or the other. They just seem to be, you know, an average side. And the goal they gave away yesterday was awful as well, with a back pass and the free kick. But that just sums up the way they've been playing recently. You know, it's just, which is surprising because Steve Bruce has usually got them organised and stuff. And they were playing good football at the start of the season, but They seem to have kind of run out of steam recently.
Well, grabbing goals wherever they're available would be one Saido Berahino. Whether they're beautiful, whether they're soft, whether they're crap, they count just the same. He had the winner in the 78th minute of this match. And I got to go to you, Kartik, our financial expert here on the World Soccer Talk pod. There's reports of Saido Berahino being sold for just £12 million. And we're talking about a player that just last week was rumored to be going for the same price as Wilfred Bony and a few others, the top echelon of strikers. What is it that's happened? Suddenly he seems a little bit more available. He goes out and he gets another goal today, a match winner in an important match for the Baggies. I mean, with the likes of Tottenham, Man United, and even my beloved Liverpool, all after the services of Saido Berahino, yes or no, and why, will he be a West Brom player as of February 1st?
Probably not. I think, obviously, he's come up through the club. I think he signed with the club when he was 11 or 12 years old, a refugee from, I can't remember which African country he's from originally, but grew up in the Birmingham area and in the West Midlands and has been with the club since he was a kid. This is the time to cash in on him. Tony Pulis can reinvest that money wisely. They've got the right manager now to keep them in the league. But I think Liverpool and Spurs in particular are going to be in a bit of a bidding war for Berahino. And then we also know Chelsea likes to drive up the cost of players that are going to sign with rivals. So don't be surprised if Chelsea doesn't make a quixotic bid to drive up the price so Liverpool ends up spending more money or Spurs end up spending more money. But I think he'll be either with Liverpool or with Spurs. And if he's with Spurs and they can go with two strikers and pair him with Harry Kane, you might see the future England front line with Berahino and Kane playing together at White Hart Lane.
Absolutely. His name is Kartik Krishnaiyer, Robin Burt, also on this program, Grant Kerr over in NYC. My name is Nate Abarea. This is the World Soccer Talk Pod. You can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And again, remember, on the Twitter sphere and everything relating to the world of the beautiful game with the hashtag WSTPod. We love your support, and we even love your abuse, so keep it coming. Loyal listeners, wonderful, intelligent panel, what do you say we hop on a train and we go to Wales? Swansea 1, West Ham 1. Andy Carroll with another goal for the Hammers. Mark Noble also scored a goal. Unfortunately for Mark Noble, it was in the wrong net, an own goal, equalizing the game. And these two squads, the Swans and the Hammers, end up sharing the spoils in Wales. Robin Burt, I want to go straight to you. I know you're a wine drinker. I'm going to bet you two bottles of good Riesling, like top shelf Riesling, and a bottle of that cheap Chardonnay crap that you drink. I'm betting you right now, this is the beginning of the descent. Next match for West Ham, at home to Hull. After that, away to Liverpool, home to Man United, away to Southampton, away to Spurs, and home to Palace in a London derby. Robin Burt, at the end of February, West Ham will be in the bottom half of the Premier League. Tell me why I'm wrong.
They won't be in the bottom half, but I agree with you that I think they're going to do what all West Ham teams have done over the last, I don't know, 20 years, ever since I've been following them and beyond that. They will probably capitulate in some format or another. I mean, Carroll was talking about, oh, we're going to finish in the top four. Well, the reality is they don't have the depth. They don't have the depth that some of these top four, five, six teams have. West Ham are going to have a good season. I really think they're going to have a good season. I think they're going to finish. My prediction is they're going to finish in seventh place. Now, there's no disgrace in that. You know, I mean, the game against Swansea was a really entertaining game. Granted, Swansea were missing some players like Bony, for example, and Shelby. But West Ham, what I liked about what they did was they took it to them. There were periods in the game where Swansea dominated the play, and then West Ham took over, but it was end to end. The problem was that when West Ham took the lead, and it was against the run of play just before half time, that was a fantastic goal by Carroll. And it just goes to prove that it's not just everything with his head. It was very quick feet. He scored. West Ham went in at the break, one up. The problem was Swansea then do what Swansea do, and they retained the ball beautifully. And they really have defined themselves over the last three, four seasons that they do pass the ball very nicely. They're going to need some players. They're going to need to buy some players in January, you know, with the loss of Boney. You know, granted, you know, when Gomez scored for them, that was good, and it came at a very important time. But West Ham nearly got back into that game. And then for the last 10 minutes, that was one of the most exciting games I've seen for a long time. And I give credit to West Ham for actually trying to go for the winner.
All right, now a credit to Andy Carroll, first off, because as a Liverpool supporter myself and someone who questions a bit of Brendan Rodgers maybe being heralded a bit too much over the years, Andy Carroll being able to look at Brendan Rodgers this season going, hey, don't you wish you had an in-form big man up top as opposed to that lumbering beat factory worker Ricky Lambert and that dud Balotelli? I bet that's got to feel damn good for Andy Carroll to be looking at the struggles of Liverpool this season, and I'm incredibly happy for what Andy Carroll has been doing. So props to you on that, Bertie. Now, you said something about Wilfred Boney as if he's already gone. And so I got to go to you, Cardick, because it's been rumored that Manchester City are ready to scoop him up for an astronomical transfer fee that no one would have ever believed at the beginning of this season. I mean, this has the makings of back when Newcastle signed Asprilla back in the mid to late 90s on a title run that ended up faltering famously with Kevin Keegan losing out to Manchester United. But are Manchester City really going to break the bank for Wilfred Boney? Will he be in sky blue as of February?
It appears like he will, and that I'll just say that I don't think it's a particularly good buy, and leave it at that, because I am I do have an article that will appear on World Soccer Talk in the next day or two. He's here for our website, worldsoccertalk.com, which will explain the reasons why. But I think it's a bit of a panic buy. Manchester City, again, because of financial fair play, everyone's having to live under this, let Alvaro Negredo go over the summer and did not buy a replacement. That deficiency of not having a big kind of target mobile striker has been evident, as well as City has played. They're only 2 points out of the top of the table. That deficiency has been very obvious for 20 matches now in the Premier League season, not having Negredo. And so they've had to overpay for a replacement in January when prices are always higher. Remember how much Andy Carroll went for in January, how much Suarez went for in January, et cetera. How much Fernando Torres, that was the big one.
50 mil.
Last January, Mata of Manchester United overpaid for him by about 10 or 15 million. So January, the prices are always higher. You see a lot of panic buys like this, and I think this is a panic buy.
Like dangling candy in front of a baby or a box of cheap Chardonnay in front of Robin Burt. Professional as ever with the teaser for that upcoming article on worldsoccertalk.com. That is, of course, Cardick Krishnire. Okay, so we took the train over to Wales. What do you say for the final three matches here on this Premier League review? We take a nice train back to merry old London, and we first off go to the north side. Arsenal 3, Stoke 0, 59,956 on hand to watch Arsenal really hop into cruise control early. Koscielny with a headed goal in the 6th minute, and then the man that, if it wasn't for Diego Costa, and I have a question for all of you on the panel relating to a comparison between Alexis Sanchez and Diego Costa in a second, but if it wasn't for Diego Costa at Chelsea, the man who scored the next 2 goals for Arsenal would be heralded as the signing of the season, without a doubt. Alexis Sanchez with another brace. Arsenal win 3-0 against a Stoke team that has the capability to play very good football. Unfortunately, it looked like long balls up to Peter Crouch. That was their only hope, and it was clear that they had absolutely no chance in this game as soon as Arsenal took an early lead. Even before Arsenal took the lead, a couple of huge chances on goal in the first 4 minutes of the game before Koscielny put the Gunners out front. But Grant, I mean, Arsenal scoring early and then bossing a Premier League match for the remaining 85 minutes, that's got to be madness. They don't do that. They don't show a spine and win games like you're supposed to. That's not what Arsenal does. Can they legitimately do this?
Well, they do it quite a lot against the kind of at home to the kind of mid-table teams. They, you know, they're not too bad at that. It's the big games that they have all the problems in. They go to Man City soon, and you know that's when you kind of they usually just capitulate. And but the home form, and today they were excellent. They're passing; they're as good as anyone. They're probably the best still when they're on their game in the league with the, you know, Cazorla and even Ozil was back today, Walcott and everyone. Very good team to watch, and Sanchez has been brilliant for them. He, you know, his energy that he brings, plays the same way whether they're winning or losing in the first minute or the 90th minute. You know, he's been, I think he's, you know, he's carried the team at times. His two goals today, especially his first goal, was excellent. But no, they were good today. Riziki was good, and they got on this, you know, they scored early, like you say, Koscielny, and then they bossed the game, but that's never really been their big problem. It's always been, that's how they can finish in the top four. They always manage to kind of get these results, but then every time they play in a so-called big game, they seem to never show up for it.
Okay, so, well, you say that, Grant. Will they finish in the top four?
I think they will. Yes, I do. I think so, yes.
Grant says Arsenal finish in the top four. I'm going to throw Birdie and Cardick on the spot right here. Alexis Sanchez or Diego Costa, you're a manager on your day. We're not talking about a full season here. We're talking about a massive, there's millions of dollars on the line. This is some underground imaginary football match. You can choose Alexis Sanchez or Diego Costa to be up front for you. Cardick, who are you taking?
I'm taking Sanchez because he's more mobile and he can do more things, although Costa's such a great goal poacher. If I have to pick one, I guess say Sanchez.
Birdie, you taking Sanchez or Costa?
I think I'm taking Sanchez because, you know, you've got to look at his record here. I mean, if you look at, you know, the Premier League season, 12 goals, 7 assists. I'm not sure how many goals, Costa has as far as assists are concerned. He's scoring goals. Yes, he's scoring goals. But you put Sanchez in that Chelsea team, and I think you'll find he's actually going to work a lot harder.
I have got to agree with the boys here. I would take Alexis Sanchez myself. If you disagree with us, be sure to let us know with the hashtag WSTPod. Hit up KKFLA737, DarthNader99, BirdieBoy11, and GrantKerrMedia. Let us know if you think that we are out of our minds saying that we would rather have Alexis Sanchez up front for our imaginary underground football team ahead of Diego Costa. You let us know. Hashtag WSTPod. Let's stay in London. Let's head to Stamford Bridge, where suddenly Jose Mourinho's boys, the special one, is back to his special ways. They seem to be title favorites again. All of us flip-floppers just flip-flopping our ways like a fish out of water over the last couple of weeks, going, is it going to be Chelsea? Is it going to be City? Jose letting us know that the Blues are the title favorites again, lulling you to sleep. You, wherever you may be listening to this podcast, weren't you lulled to sleep by what Chelsea did against Newcastle, winning this match 2-0 with two goals right on each side of the halftime break? I mean, this was Jose Mourinho football at its finest. Cardick, how can anyone say that Chelsea are not going to win the title, or is another week going to go by and Chelsea are going to falter in that blueprint that Tottenham seemed to be able to give the rest of the league back on New Year's? Is that actually going to translate into something, or is this Chelsea cruise control from here on out?
Newcastle had quite a go in this game. Props to John Carver, a manager that I know I talked to quite a bit when he was here in Major League Soccer on this side of the pond. A guy I like a lot, and I would love for him to get the Newcastle job full time. They had a go. Their finishing was poor, but they created some good chances in the first half. But as is the case generally with Mourinho teams, with the exception of that Spurs game, they get a goal and the match is on lockdown. They shut up shop and were able to see the thing out. My concern about Chelsea right now is their lack of depth. If Matic were to go down or Fabregas were to go down, they don't seem to have the depth they've had in recent years, even recent years when they finished third and fourth or sixth one year in the Premier League. Sherlock, I see rumors that he's going to be sold back to someone in Germany, maybe Dortmund, maybe Bremen. And Some of the other guys that were brought in for depth purposes, like Remy, just haven't performed very well this season. Ramirez has been hit or miss. So I think they're the favorites, but I don't know. I wouldn't say that they've got this title in the bag by any stretch of the imagination.
Robin Burt, who wins the Premier League title? Who lifts the trophy May of 2015?
I think it's probably Chelsea, and I've been flip-flopping on this one for a couple of weeks now. But, you know, I mean, they went back to what they do and what Mourinho does. He likes to close out games. You know, I mean, they didn't have a particularly good game. Newcastle really owned that first half. You know, Sissoko hit the post. If it wasn't for Oscar scoring in the 43rd minute or whatever and sort of rescuing some sort of, credibility for Chelsea there, it was really, you know, they're just going through the motions and they're doing it very, very well. I mean, there's a reason why they have 100% record at home. They know how to close out games. They know how to play certain teams in certain styles of play. And they will resort to an ugly type of game if they have to. And that is the sign of a good team. That's the sign of a good team. That's the sign of a good manager. You know,
that's the sign of Jose Mourinho being Jose Mourinho. And on New Year's Day, it was as if the special one wanted to make friends. He wanted to go out and play attractive football. That's not what Jose Mourinho does. And we debated last week on this show. We said, well, what's going to win or lose Chelsea the title is if Mourinho is interested in how people perceive him and as if he wants to make friends with fans and pundits around the world. If he goes back to Mr. Pragmatism, Mr. Call it 18th century football, call it whatever you want to call it. If he goes back to what he does best, Chelsea are going to win the title and Manchester City do not stand a chance. Their only chance, as Cardick and Nicky Hollander threw out last week, is if Jose Mourinho in these big matches gets a little bit of an ego complex. If he goes up against Arsene Wenger or Van Gaal or whoever it may be and says, "Ooh, I'm going to go out and show that my team's superior than yours," that could be the downfall of Chelsea this year. I don't see that happening. I think this 2-0 result against Newcastle is case in point that Mourinho knows what Mourinho needs to do, and that is play ugly and not worry about what anybody thinks of him as a footballing mind, because he has got championships and trophies galore to show everybody and shut them up. I said we're going to London for the final three matches. And we're going to end at Selhurst Park with what had to be the best spectacle of the weekend. I know I said it was kind of a down weekend in the Premier League. Not a lot of goals, not a whole heck of a lot of excitement. But oh my goodness, what would be the Saturday morning fixture, nationally televised on NBC here in America, the Saturday nighter over there in England, a classic London derby, Palace 2, Tottenham 1. The first match of the Alan Pardew managerial era for the Eagles of Crystal Palace. A relatively tame first 45 minutes was followed by a wild, and I mean wild, second half, backed all the while by the soundtrack of that spine-tingling Selhurst Park atmosphere. Spurs wonder kid Harry Kane scored a fantastic goal in the 49th minute, a low drive that went into the side netting, gave the keeper absolutely no chance, and Tottenham looked like they were going to build off of that result, that wacky 5-3 spectacular win against Chelsea on New Year's Day. But no, they showed that they are still the most inconsistent side in all the land. Dwight Gayle smacked home a penalty with just textbook form. One of the best penalties I've seen taken in quite some time. Hammered low and hard, straight into the corner, straight into the side netting. That equalized things. In the 69th minute, Jason Puncheon with a well-worked winner in the 80th. And Crystal Palace, under Alan Pardew, the commentators, whether in England, whether on NBC, with Arlo White and a few other people, saying, God, this has the feeling of Pulis Part 2. This has the feeling of Palace developing momentum with this spine-tingling atmosphere behind them. Cardick, can this be 2014 springtime all over again? Because everything would lead me to believe that, yes, Crystal Palace could go on a run and end up finishing in the top half.
Maybe not quite the Pulis run. I mean, I think if you actually take the table from the time Pulis took over for Palace, they would have been in the top six or seven in the league. I'm not sure Pardew quite has that, but Pardew is a manager who plays a little more open style. Verdi knows him well from his time at West Ham, getting you guys to the FA Cup final, which you would have won if Stevie G hadn't had that yes. ridiculous goal, yes. that lucky goal, Nate.
Take it easy,
West Ham could have lifted the trophy that season. But getting back to this match, Pardew is a good manager. You know, Newcastle, the Northeast, is a tough place to manage. Sunderland and Newcastle, we talk about it all the time, consistently underachieve. They have good managers who do well elsewhere, who just don't perform well there, although Pardew almost got them into the Champions League one of the seasons he was there. So I think they will go on a run. I'm not sure they finish in the top half, but they should have a close the season strong. The flip side of this match, guys, though, Spurs, this is just typical Spurs. I mean, I guess we should have known they would lose this match, right?
Well, Grant, I want to go to you. Are Tottenham Hotspur the most inconsistent side that you have ever seen? Because I think back into the memory banks. I'm trying to think of teams that are able, from one match to another, I have never seen anything like Tottenham this season, going from what they did New Year's Day against Chelsea to this. I mean, there's no progression about it whatsoever. Would you say that they're the most inconsistent side, perhaps in all of England?
Yeah, I would have to say they are. And it's not, you know, the level of high is so high. Like, they're beating the potential champions, you know, the best team in the league. And they didn't, you know, they absolutely smashed them. And then they drop, then they go. But it isn't a surprise. They go to Selhurst Park. And I don't think the fans are that surprised, because it's one step forward, two steps back. It just seems to always be the case with Tottenham. And we discussed it before a few weeks ago when Nick asked me, you know, maybe why I thought so. And I don't know if you remember, I said, you know, it's down to, like, they don't have any players that identify the club. And just the way they've got a bunch of good players, but not a team. When you look at Crystal Palace, the reason they won yesterday is because, you know, the fans and the team and everyone's in it together. Tottenham's a collection of very good footballers, but they just don't seem to have, and it can't be that every coach isn't good. You know, it doesn't really add up that every coach, you know, there's something in there. I don't know what it is, if, you know, someone should try and find out. I mean, Harry Kane's been doing really well. So he's been their bright, you know, the bright point yesterday. Again, he scored even though he was offside. But yeah, there's such a, it's frustrating for, like, me, and I have no feeling towards Spurs. So I can't imagine what it's like for the fans, you know.
I despise them, and it's frustrating for me. I mean, I don't understand how a team can do what they do. It literally blows my mind as an observer of the sport. It really doesn't add up. It doesn't make any sense. I actually very much like Mauricio Pochettino and what Nicky Hollander, our good friend, who's a frequent guest on this show. I mean, he's talked about what Pochettino has done, actually, is built a bit of a homegrown attitude with Tottenham, and that they're not going out. They realized the mistakes that they made post-Gareth Bale money after the sale to Real Madrid. And there is legitimately something brewing at White Hart Lane right now that could be a force in years to come. I could see Tottenham building off of this season, but they have got to get any level of consistency. Until they can do that, there's no building, there's no going forward. And real quickly, before we end this match, Nicky Hollander, who was supposed to actually appear on this edition of the World Soccer Talk pod, diehard Tottenham supporter, Nicky Hollander, suddenly came down with a nasty flu bug early Saturday afternoon after Tottenham blew this match at Selhurst Park. All right, Nicky, look forward to talking with you next week. Robin Burt, you are a Londoner. You are a Londoner through and through. We've talked so much on this show, off the air, about derby matches in England. The fact that for a Scouser, for a Liverpool supporter, there's two derby matches a year out of 38. For a Mancunian, for a Manc, there's two derby matches a year. You get to play home and away, whether you're City or United. In London, there's five or six, or even sometimes, depending on who's in the league, there's seven derby matches, 14 right. derby matches a year. It's spectacular. This had the emotion of a classic London Derby. And when the one moment where the Palace support actually went quiet for a couple minutes, and suddenly when the Spurs go marching in, just rain down from the away stands. I mean, this was beautiful. This was a London Derby at its finest. And I want to ask you, as a proud Londoner, what your favorite moment or aspect from this match was, because there were so many great storylines within. What did you take away from this 2-1 victory for Palace against Tottenham?
Yeah, I'm not sure what my favorite moment was, but, you know, I mean, you cannot underestimate a London derby, just like you can't underestimate what happens in Liverpool or Manchester or in Glasgow. You know, these are important games for the communities, you know, in those cities. And London, like you said, there are 5 teams in the Premier League right now, which means there are 10 London derbies. And sometimes there's not a lot of rhyme or reason to some of those results. I think when West Ham played Arsenal, we were unlucky not to get something out of that game. But, you know, we will go to the Emirates and we'll probably get a good old spanking there. But anytime you can take a team home and play them at home, Palace, I mean, it's this whole sort of new manager sort of, you know, sort of uptick. You bring in a new manager like Pardew, who played for Crystal Palace, was, you know, scored a very important goal. It becomes an icon. I didn't see Palace winning that game. When Spurs went 1-0 up with Harry Kane, I thought, okay, here we go. They're going to do just nicely here. But Palace, they stayed in the game. They fought and they worked. And I've seen this. I've seen this so many times with these, you know, with these derby games. There is no rhyme or reason. And that is why I was so happy that Palace got that one goal back, got the penalty, and then it was game on. It reminded me of Liverpool against you know, Crystal Palace, when Crystal Palace thought, yeah, they took it by the scruff of the neck and we went, we can do this. And Spurs have been playing well of late. So the fact that Palace, you know, went and beat them 2-1 is, and I always go on about this, is why we love the Premier League, because some of these results don't make sense. You wouldn't have had Palace winning that game. But I do think there will be an uptick, you know, there will be an uptick, just like there will be with Pulis. He will bring something to that West Bromwich Albion team that, you know, that Irvine couldn't do. And so, yeah, love it.
Crystal Palace are going to go on a second half tear. I'm calling 10th place for Alan Pardew's Crystal Palace side. They're going to go on a run of epic proportions. Not quite, as Cardick threw out there, not quite a Pulis run, but they are going to go on quite the tear, and Palace are going to end the season strong. Chelsea are going to hop into cruise control January 31st. We talk about teasers on this show. Manchester City take on Chelsea. How amazing would it be to see Frank Lampard score a goal again against Chelsea in that match? We shall see. Liverpool are climbing their way back up again. Laugh at me all you want, Twitter followers, fans of the show. Just 5 points off of fourth place as we stand right now. Want to end the show with a couple quick shout-outs to the SoCal U17 ODP team, coached by one Nick Webster. That's right, our favorite Mr. Clean, Uncle Fester lookalike, doing American soccer good and taking the boys to Arizona and putting on a pretty darn good showing this weekend, winning a handful of matches down there in the desert. And a shout out to the team that I coach, the JV boys here at Shasta High School in Redding, California, the Shasta Wolves, who played a nasty, hard-fought Derby Day, dare I say, draw against the Crosstown Enterprise Hornets. 3-3 draw between Shasta and Enterprise in that match back on Friday night. Good on you, boys. Let's build on it. The U17 SoCal ODP team and the 14 and 15-year-olds here in Reading with the purple plaid Shasta Wolves. For the illustrious panel down in Los Angeles, Birdie, the Fat Man, Tubby, Robin, West Ham, Bert, for Cardick Krishnayer down in FLA, and Grant Kerr up in the Big Apple in NYC. My name is Nate Aberea, coming to you from Redding, California. Again, you can subscribe to the show via TuneIn, Stitcher, and iTunes at World Soccer Talk on the Twitter sphere, hashtag WST Pod, for all of your tweets relating to this this show, the world of the beautiful game, and all of the abuse that you want to give to any of us on this panel. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Always a pleasure. We will talk next week. And until then, take care.
Go Green Bay.